You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning. Kind of a sleepy news week, don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there's crazy stuff happening. Like, for example, the Gosar video that was last week, and he just was censured by Congress. And then Boebert went on the floor and said some crazy stuff about the quote unquote jihad squad. So, like, in a normal world, that would be a crazy week, but it's kind of like a yawn for us, like in this the sort of like bizarro world we live in.
I mean, it probably is more on cable news than I recognize. I mean, I like that, like the ghost art kind of thing. I just kind of tune it out. Like, not that, I mean, I understand, yeah. I'm not against them being censured or anything, but it's like, I don't care.
Of privilege, Bill. That's a form of privilege, being able to tune that out.
Well, I wouldn't write about it. I got nothing to say about it. You know, he did something awful and he gets censured. You know, end of discussion for me. There's no insight beyond that.
His excuse is interesting. I don't know if you've caught this, but he made this like anime video where he kills AOC in the video.
Right.
His excuse when people ask him about it, he's like, well, we're trying to reach out to young people like this anime thing. We're trying to like do it, you know, and it's like, that's his. Anyway,
there's a really important pro-murder constituency that I need to connect with if I'm going to build a governing coalition.
Young people love this stuff. it's a weird, weird thing. So it's, you know, and then I feel like when, you know, I'm not sure when Joe Biden gave his Build Back Better speech. I think it was Monday, which was this week, but it feels
that was the infrastructure bill.
I'm sorry.
Bill signing.
Yeah, the victory lap for the bipartisan infrastructure signing ceremony.
Yes.
Right. I'm sorry. It feels like that was weeks ago. That was, I think, Monday, right?
Right.
Did you see? I thought Kyrsten Sinema did really well in her speech, which was very bipartisan.
Well, I mean, I wrote this in June. When they first had the tentative agreement, and it was already being billed as Sinema Portman, and I said this is validating the Sinema, you know, political worldview. You know, I mean, she ran in 2018 as a bipartisan independent problem solver. A lot of people in the Democratic Party said, you know, stop trying to be the maverick. You need to play to your base. Arizona's getting bluer. You need to juice, you need to get a Latino vote, a Native American vote. Stop trying to, you know, reach across the aisle. And if you do, we'll primary you. And she has ignored that consistently. And whether or not it's the wrong strategy or not, at the end of the day, she has gotten a great deal of validation, and not just in June, the initial agreement, but she held out to say, I'm not going to pass Build Back Better until you pass my infrastructure bill first. Finally, the progressives backed down off their demand and passed the bill, the other week or so ago. And so now she gets her bill signing ceremony. She gets to stand next to Rob Portman, as well as some of the other moderate House members. They get that footage for their campaign ads. And I mean, and Sinema literally gets Sinema Portman. You know, so when she's up in 2024, if someone wants to challenge her on the left, I mean, obviously, a whole sort of things can happen between now and then, but presumably she'll be able to say, you see that road, that bridge, that transit system, that broadband, that water? You know, Sinema Portman did that. I told you I was going to come to Washington, work across the aisle, and I did, and I delivered. So I think she's looking quite good. I mean, we're not seeing instant poll bump for Joe Biden. I saw Quinnipiac just came out. It's terrible. Was it 36%, 38%? You know, you don't imminently get the impact of infrastructure when you pass the bill. It takes time to actually build the stuff. But I would think by 2024, she's going to look pretty good with this.
Yeah, that's the hope. And I think Biden might have gotten more of a bump if it had happened quicker. Like if it hadn't been such a painful, arduous process of passing this legislation, it was very ugly. It was very messy.
Well, the legislation is often like that.
It is. Yeah, it is. But you're right. I mean, at some point, people are going to have bridges and roads and stuff and ribbon cuttings and all that. And, you know, there are people who go to Congress for a career who never actually get any legislation done, you know, certainly not of this magnitude. So, like,
I mean, this first
say
term,
what you will about cinema.
This she has been in the Senate for less than 3 years, and she has her name on a $1 trillion piece of legislation. I mean, that does not happen every day for every senator.
Yeah. Say what you will about cinema, but she put points on the board. And this will be on her permanent record, as they say. So, you know, we stand for cinema. we're on the record. We're on the record for that. So, Bill, you've been writing about inflation, and this is something that is somewhat complicated. It seems like it's not going away anytime soon, even though Biden has called it transitory, and I think ignored the warnings of some economists early on. But what's your take on what we're, you know, is this a product of the supply chain, or is this too much spending?
I mean. As I always say, not an economist. I'm not here to be the final arbiter of this question. I mean, there is a decent argument that I've read that this is really not so much American Rescue Plan, you know, overstimulation. This is more pandemic-related supply chain disruption, which will eventually work itself out. So it may not feel so transitory right now, but like Paul Krugman had a column saying this is more like post-war 1946 to 1948 inflation than it is, you know, 1970s inflation. And so, and Krugman's point was people started fighting inflation hard by like 1949, but by then it actually had worked itself out, and the stuff they were doing was then became negative for the economy. Yeah. So it could be. So both Moody's and Goldman Sachs have projected that inflation by end of 2022 will settle down to close to 2%, which is about where you want it to be. That's the Fed target is 2%, and the year to year that just came out was 6.2. So there'll be a pretty big deceleration if that happened. So it may be that you could just do nothing, and by the midterms, it's all going to work out. The risk is that, one, you know, the agents could be wrong, that even if it does settle down on its own, the timing not might not be advantageous, number one. Number two, and I think this is a fairly fundamental problem for Democrats in general, for almost any Democratic presidency, because Democrats always want to come in and do something big. You know, there's always some sort of deep-seated, protracted problem. And being believers in active government, they want to come and solve that problem. And all the energy gets put into some kind of long-range reform, but the median voter is upset about what's happening right now. What is the problem affecting me today?
Well, and the thing is, I mean, what makes this really tough for Biden is that it's just sort of like intuitively, you can't escape it. I mean, just Bill, yesterday you know, three of us, I had lunch with my mom yesterday. There were three of us in Frederick, Maryland, at an okay restaurant, nice restaurant. But, you know, my mom called me late. She picked up the tab and she called me later and said, like, hey, Matt, how much do you think lunch costs today? And I said, like, you wouldn't have asked that unless it was ridiculously cheap or ridiculously expensive. I'm going to go high. I'm going to say $60. And she's like, no, it was $100. Like, this wasn't Fiola,
right?
And it wasn't dinner, and I had no drinks. I mean, I had a coffee and an iced tea. I didn't have, you know, so that's, to me, I'm like, I can't go back to that restaurant anymore. That's like ridiculous.
But is it any different than any other restaurant of that caliber that you've gone to?
I can't drop $100 on a like Wednesday lunch. It didn't take like 10. It was three of us, too. It wasn't like, I mean, if it was a huge, like I took my office out to lunch. OK, you know, 10 people or something. So like, but then gas prices, I'm just saying, like, this doesn't mean Biden's to blame, and it doesn't mean his policies that are to blame. But what it means is we get this, like this isn't like an esoteric thing that may someday, like right now, it feels like things cost a lot more money than they should. Right. And that's a political problem.
And whether or not Biden is to blame for it, I mean, it's not an irrelevant question, but even if he is not to blame, even if it's not because of American Rescue Plan, he's still the guy in charge, and there's an expectation he's going to try to do something about it. And, you know, even if that thing is, I shouldn't do anything, that needs to be communicated in some way. So people have a sense of like, okay, I know I'm in this rough situation, but I have some confidence that if I wait it out for 6 months, you know, it's all going to be okay. And you're giving me some reasoning to have confidence in that view. You can't just sit around and point fingers and say forget it. It's not, and make excuses. You still have to be in charge. And if the thing you're doing, spending most of your energy on, is irrelevant to that, is on something else entirely, that's confusing for people. I think Obama got stuck with that. You know, when he was fighting for a healthcare reform in the middle of the recession, a massive job loss. And he passed the Recovery Act, which eventually, you know, added jobs and got us on the right track. But it took time. And in the interim period, there are people like, why aren't you focused on this? Jimmy Carter pushing energy independence for years when inflation was going up and up and up and up. And Carter was very cognizant of inflation being a problem. And one thing that's very interesting that I just discovered in doing my research for this last piece. 2 weeks before the 78 midterm, he gives an Oval Office address about inflation. I mean, it's not, like you are going out of your way to draw attention to a problem right before the midterm. And it's not even like he has like a magic solution for it. He's even saying openly, like, you know, I don't have easy answers and no one has easy answers. But we're going to try this, and this. And that 78 midterm wasn't that bad.
He probably shouldn't have done that.
Democrats had a pretty good midterm in 78. I mean, they lost some seats, but they had big majorities, so they didn't lose control of Congress.
Might have been rewarded for at least talking about it.
Didn't hurt. I mean, I can't know. I can't.
I do think in general, Carter's penchant for, you know, kind of being honest about things was generally not helpful to his cause. But there are, you know, sometimes the public may reward that.
Well, the thing about Carter that's interesting is in this inflation regard, he had three different Fed chairs over the course of his one term. And the first two were dovish.
Which, putting it in perspective, Alan Greenspan was Fed chairman for what, 20 years?
I mean, he's one of the longer ones. He came in under Reagan, late term Reagan, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
And he went through Bush.
So anyway, he had a good run, certainly. Yeah.
For Carter's second Fed chair, like in early 79, some of Carter's aides started publicly nudging that Fed chair to raise rates, and Carter told them to stand down. But by the later part of 79, Carter had it with all the economic advice his advisors had given him that hadn't worked. And he finally went to Paul Volcker, knowing that Volcker was going to be a super hard ass. There's actually a scene where, like, Volcker's this really big, like 6'7" guy, and he's being interviewed by Carter, and Volcker's like splayed out on the couch, going on about how, like, he's going to, you know, raise rates and like crush inflation and whatnot. And afterwards, Volcker's like, I'm never going to get this. You know, I did not handle an interview professionally or properly. But Carter was fed up and said to him, you know, you take care of the economy, I'll take care of the politics. you know, and what happened was that Volcker raised rates super high. He induces a recession. I mean, economic growth was positive under Carter for his first 3 years. It was an overheated economy. And then you have a recession in 1980 and Carter loses. But it is what was the stiff medicine was needed to get inflation in check, and it's essentially been pretty much in check ever since until now. Yeah. So the question is, for Biden, does he need the Fed to come in now? Maybe not raise rates to Volcker levels and like go crazy, but is it early enough in the process you can kind of tick it up and try to, you know, tamp things down? Or,
but they're hoping,
do you still risk a recession by doing that?
Yeah.
And if Moody's and Goldman are saying, look, just wait it out, it's going to be okay, do you wait it out? I don't know the answer to that. What I know is
so he's obviously hoping that it's the supply chain, the COVID sort of problem. But, you know, Bill, the problem is that like inflation can have like a psychological impact. So, for example, I go to lunch and it's expensive. Why is it expensive? Well, I don't know. Maybe they can't hire enough workers, right? So you have to pay their workers more money. Whatever the reason is, my lunch was more expensive. Now I'm going to go to my boss and say, I need more money. Gas prices are too high. Lunch, I couldn't even, you know, can't get lunch for under $100. I mean, come on, I need a raise. If that starts to happen, and then my company has to raise prices on, you know, then you could actually have this thing kind of spiral out of control and take on a life of its own, even though it was started by something that wasn't because of overspending and was perfectly understandable and maybe even predictable given a global pandemic.
I mean, look what happened in the 70s. You know, inflation doesn't start with Carter. Inflation starts with Nixon. And Nixon was completely crass and cynical and Machiavellian about it. So, I mean, you know, he's not a liberal, but he embraces wage and price controls to try to clamp down inflation in 71, with no game plan how to get out of wage price controls. And then in 72, he leans on his Fed chair to lower interest rates, which is contradictory to trying to solve inflation. But he wants to juice the economy for his reelection, which is what happens. So he gets through his reelection, Jim Dandy, and it's like, okay, well, how do I get out of these wage and price controls? And when he finally does it in 74, inflation goes through the roof because they did nothing to solve anything underlying. They just put a Band-Aid over it for a time. And then that problem gets handed off to Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford does the feckless whip inflation now campaign, which was a total bust. Although inflation does ebb. I mean, inflation was double digits in 74. It comes down to like 5-6%, I think, by 76. So it's better, but it's not good. And it's not like the issue in the 76 campaign. But still, Carter walks in 77 knowing this is still a problem. I mean, he knew from the get-go it was a problem, but just didn't have the answer for it. Because the only remaining answer was something that was going to be recessionary. And then no one wants to embrace that solution.
Well, and you know, Carter, you know, every politician wants to get reelected, but if you have Donald Trump as the possible, you know, beneficiary of a recession, then it's even maybe even something you are less inclined to want to take your medicine now if you think that could be the result.
And so to get back to Biden, I mean, this Quinnipiac poll where Biden's in the 30s job approval. Infrastructure bill is still at 58%. Build Back Better is at 58%. Like, the agenda is still popular. But he can't expect passing the bills to fix his approval and fix the short-term Democratic problem if people are still upset about their near-term disruptions, which is not even just inflation, mind you. I mean, you know, I go to the store still and I see empty shelves for certain things. I feel like a cranky old man making a, you know, hysterical stories, but I swear to you, this is true. I was in a tiny, you know, sort of bodega type convenience store. Actually, one that was that is a is an Indian grocery, but has, you know, just, you know, sodas and drinks. When I tend to go in there to get a water bottle for my kid when she has a thing nearby. And I've been there
three times. And that's where you buy your weed.
This is like the third time I've been there in the past few weeks. I don't know if the person recognized me or what, but I was going looking for just a water bottle and I couldn't find one. And he said, "Are you looking for a water bottle?" "Yeah, I don't have any. I don't have any right now. I can't get employees to come to work or stay on the job. And so I'm stuck here and I can't go out and like get the supply."
Wow.
For the store. And so I bought like a liter bottle of seltzer instead of like a tiny bottle of water. And so I spent $2 instead of $1. I was going to throw that day. So like those sorts of like, I mean, is this the apocalypse? No, but there's lots, I think, of sort of little inconveniences like that that are going on that make people feel like I'm not back to normal and I want to be back to normal.
Yeah. It's so weird to me, the whole like people not being able to hire people. It's such an interesting thing that's happening right now. Something's okay. Up.
It was 18 months ago when all we could be told is we're going to be taken over by robots and you're not going to be able to find work.
Yeah.
Or at least we automated and there'd be no jobs for you. And instead, we literally have record numbers of people quitting. We had 4.4 million people quitting in a month. And numbers have been, and we've been over 3 million quits a month for I think the past 2 years. So, I mean, it even goes a little bit, I think, yeah, predating the pandemic.
Look, and first of all, number one, this will spur more automation, not less. But I get not wanting to work. Jobs suck. I worked at a gas station behind glass for 5 years. I was putting myself going to college at the same time. So it wasn't 40 hours a week, but you know, I've worked at restaurants and it's, you know, it's not great. I work is, you know, what is it that Jack Kennedy said? What was the line about, you know, you've never worked a day in your life or something? And he's like, somebody came up to him and said, like, I tried it once, it's overrated, you know, like, you know, the Studs Terkel like work thing. It's, I get why people don't want to do it. What I don't understand is how they can afford not to do it, right? There's so many people checking out. And, you know, I think you could argue when there were all these very generous COVID benefits that maybe they could go, oh, you know, and plus when your kids are home from school, you know, because of COVID and you're getting some COVID stimulus checks or like, but I don't understand how it is endured. Like, I get that people don't want to work and I don't even fault them. I totally understand it. I don't understand how people are able to afford not working to this degree.
Yeah. When you have a theory? I don't have a great theory. We're past the point of free government cheese, you know, so you can't pin it on that anymore. We don't have the enhanced unemployment. I haven't seen a analysis done of, you know, the demographics of the quitters. I mean, maybe it's out there and I'm just unaware of it. I just haven't seen it myself. But I would like to see that because, I mean, look 4.4 million people quitting. You know, we're a nation of over 300 million people. There are a whole lot of people that don't have that luxury still. I mean, yeah. That could be that might still be a rarefied, large but rarefied strata of people who have the luxury of saying, you know what, I can go for another few months without work. I got reserves. I can stay with friends. I can stay with my parents. I don't need to work at this menial job. I'm going to wait for something better. Or I got bored with this one thing and I want to switch it up and find something different.
Yeah. There is a way of looking at this that's like, look, people were too consumeristic before. Now, you know, one parent is going to stay home with the, you know, we're going to tighten our belts. Like, we don't need to go to that $100 lunch. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to make a little less money, but we're going to be more focused on family and connection and things that matter. And like, we're not going to be as consumeristic. Or on the other hand, now I'm going to pursue a dream or something. Like, there's a lot of positive possibilities of this. If you're a conservative, whether you're entrepreneurial or whether you're just family values focused. But again, how do people pay the bill? You know,
well, it's also, I mean, there's benefits from a liberal progressive standpoint. With workers being more demanding, puts pressure on employers to raise wages and benefits, make their and improve their workplaces. So, I mean, the thing that progressives have always wanted, stronger unions to give workers more bargaining leverage, at least for this, I mean, maybe it's not sustainable over a long period of time, but for the moment, they're getting the benefit of that without the unions. Because people are naturally kind of banding together and saying, you, can, you know what, I don't,
you can
I don't
negotiate.
Need this job.
You can negotiate and bargain on behalf of yourself. If they, if you are in demand, if labor is in demand, then you can say, pay you, if you want me to work here, you need to pay me $15 an hour or whatever the market will bear. It's a free market.
Right.
And maybe it caught, maybe lunch costs $100. And, you know, I think that there's been a sense that cheap consumer goods and a lot of activity is the thing that we should, the thing we ought to prioritize. Well, this is the other side of the coin. It's like maybe you have lunch less, you pay a little more, and the people who work there make more money.
Well,
from a progressive standpoint, this could be a good.
It may well be that, you know, if once we're 2 years out of the pandemic, that we're going to come out of it better than when we came in, you know, obviously, except for the people who, you know, lives were lost and lives were damaged from poor health. I don't want to be glib about that.
Except for the hundreds of thousands of dead.
Right. But from a macroeconomic standpoint, the economy actually might be in a sturdier place when we're out of it. The risk for Democrats is
I would hope that there is something of a silver lining if we go through this whole thing, that some... That's some good. I mean, I can just tell you from a macro standpoint, I think that this experience has probably in some ways made me better and made me rethink things. And I would certainly hope that as a society, we do that.
From a political standpoint for Democrats, if the timing of that is not ideal, if that's not evident by November 2022, not just that you might lose that midterm, which is again very typical for a president's party to lose a midterm, but does the Democratic agenda get discredited? Does it suffer the blame for the short-term problem? I mean, it might not really be American Rescue Plan, but you know full well that inflation remains high. The Republicans are going to say, you guys overshot, you guys pumped more money into the system than you needed to, you refused to work with us on a more modest bill, you did it yourself, you threw money at the problem, and now the whole country's paying the price. And so the next time that you want to spend money on something, people are going to second guess and say, well, maybe we shouldn't do that because we tried that last time and everything got thrown out of whack. I think there's the Democrats and progressives need to worry. I mean, not to the point of paralysis, now that they should shelve Build Back Better, but they should recognize that there's a potential for their basic belief system to get severely bruised, fairly or unfairly, because things might not work out as nicely and quickly as their policies would, you know, otherwise do.
I agree. But I would say this, and some of this may just be unavoidable for Joe Biden, right? But he invited a lot. I mean, you could trace the beginning of the end for Joe Biden to the Afghanistan withdrawal, which I always thought was a mistake to begin with and which was incredibly botched. You've got the border crisis. You've got, you know the crime thing is probably something that Biden inherited. But and then I think you've got
all these things are inherited. You know, these are all inherited problems.
Well, but some of them are different. But I think you've got the culture war stuff too, which you can't really blame Joe Biden for. But the left, I think you can. And I guess my point is that if in fact things go really, really bad for Joe Biden, and the kind of progressive program is maligned or discredited as a result. Some of it may be like just bad luck, but some of it I think was invited by Biden. Like if Biden had governed differently, things may have gone differently.
You know, it's hard to do alternative timelines here, but I do wonder if Biden started with a bipartisan rescue plan. If he accepted what Susan Collins is offering, which was below $1 trillion, or if he got Collins up to $1 trillion or $1.2 trillion, didn't go for the $1.9 trillion, you know, that I don't think that the economy would have tanked if they had less relief. I think they probably still needed something. And so they could argue, like, look, we've had pretty good job growth, you know, over the course of the year. So it's, I don't think that what they did was bad, but they probably could have gone away with less.
Yeah.
And broken the ice with Republicans on the front end. And then when you shifted to infrastructure, you know, we had this whole period with infrastructure in the spring and summer where some Democrats and people on the left were saying, don't waste your time. Don't trust these people. Yeah, they're never going to do it. They're never going to give you the margin of victory for it. They're never going to. I mean, maybe they'll jump along for the ride if we're going to do it ourselves. But they'll never actually get you over the finish line. And so why bother when you just do it all in reconciliation anyway? And we wasted months to get to this point when we passed the infrastructure bill. So I think the infrastructure bill would have happened a lot quicker if you had a bipartisan win, you know, in January or February.
Yeah.
And then you still could have moved to Build Back Better once that was done. I can't know, you know, if, you know, maybe they wouldn't have gotten to. I mean, there was a time when I could say, if I said, you know what, they could have done something with Susan Collins, people would say, no, they couldn't. They were going to do loosing the football with that. You know they would never follow through. Well, now my argument's stronger because they didn't do loosing the football with infrastructure. They literally were the margin of victory. So I think that was a possible thing, and I think it would have made for a less dramatic, less tense year.
Yeah. Biden's, for people who've forgotten, Biden's first move out of the box was to listen to Republicans who came to the White House to meet with him, who wanted to do a bipartisan, and who, by the way, who had just voted like a month earlier for a ton of money for a different COVID relief package. They had already voted for that once, like in December. Biden's first move, his first big move as president, is to kind of placate them with a meeting and then immediately say, we're not, you know, full speed ahead. We're going to do this ourselves. And I thought, in fact, I actually thought that was going to be more damaging than it even turned out to be. Like, I thought that was going to really poison the well for bipartisan compromise. And I mean, to Republicans' credit, that would have been a good excuse. If they didn't want to cooperate, they could have said, we tried to do a deal with him and he screwed us over, but they still stuck with it.
It's quite impressive that they pulled infrastructure out of the hat, even though they were shunted to the side. I mean, they shunted Collins to the side on a rescue plan. They shunted Capito to the side in the initial infrastructure talks. You know, they only got it out of the infrastructure bill out.
And then when they announced, the day they announced, they have a bipartisan, like 10 Republicans or whatever are on stage, and they announce the bipartisan bill. And Biden says, out of, you know, apropos of nothing, from our standpoint, from the viewer's standpoint, oh yeah, we're going to link this together with the other bill. They'll pass at the same time. And like, people on stage are like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't sign up for this. Amazing.
But they got it. They still, I mean, at least they got that much. And so, you know, I have, you know, a glimmer of hope. I mean, it's not a strong hope, but combination of getting infrastructure passed and Glenn Youngkin winning, that some Republicans might say, you know what, we can do things like this and it's going to make us look good. We don't have to worry about, look, we passed infrastructure and Biden's still in the 30s. It's not like doing this stuff is going to automatically help him in the near term. And I look like less of a schmuck because I'm doing what people want. These are popular bills. So maybe you could get out a couple more bipartisan wins next year. You know, Bill Clinton's crime bill was August of 94. It was 3 months before the midterm. I mean, healthcare, you know, they were trying to get healthcare at the last minute. They couldn't get mm-hmm. it. But crime bill was a bipartisan bill where Republicans were the margin of victory.
See, that's interesting. Was Newt, do you remember or do you know if Newt was on board with this or if he was trying to put the kibosh on it?
I don't think so. I would doubt it. I mean, it was only, I think it was like 46 Republicans. Like, I would be very shocked if Newt was one of them. Remember, conservatives right away hammered that bill as, you know, liberal nonsense gone awry. Midnight basketball. Yeah, this wasn't seen as like a punitive three strikes and you're out bill. So I assume Newt was not on board with it. But there were some Democrats who were not for it, thinking it was too punitive, yeah. And you needed those 46 Republicans to get it passed. And they needed Republicans in the Senate, too. And it didn't say, and Bill Clinton tried very hard in the fall, like, you know, Washington's working, we're working across the aisle, getting stuff done. I mean, crime was the biggest issue at the time. But of course, it didn't like magically drop crime rates.
Right, right.
He didn't get the instant payoff from it.
Indeed. Well,
so what else we want to talk about?
Yeah. What else you want to talk about?
Since Biden is stuck with these terrible poll numbers, people are looking past 2022 and going to 2024. Is Biden going to run again? If Biden doesn't run, is it going to be Kamala? And Kamala's getting a fresh wave of bad press.
Dude.
I mean, something out of nowhere. Like at least the last time this happened in June, like she had made a gaffe. She had that bad interview with NBC about not going to the border. Like, this is just kind of coming out of nowhere.
And it seems like, I mean, there are certainly like allegations or insinuations that like that Biden's team is like planting bad stories for her. But I mean, I have to tell you, I saw a video on on Twitter. I mean, it's selectively edited, but it was like a 2 minute long video. And I mean, it was like her just bullshitting, like, we got to come together because when we come together in unity, united, you know, it's just like, it's like Selena, you know, like from Veep. I mean, like just bullshitting, like coming up with stuff. Like, it would be like if you told me you need to get up and give an extemporaneous speech about, you know, whatever, inflation for 5 minutes, like in front of a college class, no preparation. Like, that's kind of what it was. I mean, she is so bad at this.
Okay, but
it's even almost indefinable how bad she just doesn't have it.
I would suggest you go back and look at vice presidential speeches over the past 50 years.
Great.
You tell me where the bar of quality is. How many of those are, you know, tautological platitudes? How many of those are overly cautious, you know, bits of fluff? How many times have they been sent out, hey, VB, go out to deep right field and do this nonsense thing?
Okay, but back then, you could do that and it would, like, you would go to like Grand Forks, North Dakota and give a speech, and like it might air on the local station. You know, right. What I mean? Like,
you wouldn't get a super cut on YouTube.
Yeah. So the standards are higher. I mean, I think people are going to also say, like, sexism. I think Jen Psaki said like racism, sexism, something to that effect. But like, no, she's really bad. But what may not be fair to her is that it's not in Grand Forks or Minot. You know what I mean? It's on my phone every day.
You know, there's a certain paradox to being vice president, because they're often maligned. They don't have a real job. They don't have a built-in set of responsibilities. Yeah. So they're always treated like this sort of worthless appendage. And It's quite rare for a sitting VP to get elected president right off the bat. It's, you know, it's Van Buren and George H.W. Bush, and I think that's it. However, a lot of VPs do become president. Either they get elected, you know, non-consecutively after their term is over, or they're elevated because of a resignation or death. So you'd so much rather be VP than not be VP. As far as like odds of becoming president, like being VP is pretty darn good shot if you're there. So I think on one hand, like one point is like whatever
Dan Quayle gaining acceptance in the polls.
I mean, Quayle is the only VP since the modern presidential primary system. He's the only VP to not get his party's nomination, having chosen to run. He briefly ran in 2000 and then backed out for Iowa. Yeah.
Every other that one has an asterisk because the president, his boss's son, ran against him.
That's right. That's right. So there's someone else in the mix who was seen as an extension of the past president. Yep. And of course, Quayle had his own demerits, being someone who can't spell.
Yeah.
Now,
I think that Quayle mostly got a. I mean, I'm not saying he's a genius, but. Mm-hmm. I think he probably got a raw deal.
He saved the republic from Donald Trump. Let's give.
Yeah.
We'd be in a constitutional crisis if not for Dan Quayle telling Mike Pence you had to ratify the Electoral College count. Now here's another interesting thing that I was thinking about, 'cause I might write about this soon. There are basically two kinds of VPs. There's the VP that has more Washington experience than the president. And the kind that has less Washington experience than the president. And we've had such a run of sort of outsider-y presidents that we've had a long stretch of VPs with more Washington experience.
Yeah.
So we really we haven't had the less Washington experience person since Bush Quayle.
Like, who could have more Washington experience than Biden?
I mean, Biden's like, one of the longest resumes of all history.
Leahy or something. I mean, like who alive has more Washington experience?
So, you know, what happens when you have the more outsidery president and the insidery vice president, and the outsidery president's having a rough patch, the natural punditry trajectory is, well, maybe we should elevate the vice president. You know, maybe Jimmy Carter should get the heck out of there and Walter Mondale should run in 1980. We didn't have that. We're not having that now with Biden because his VP is, you know, quasi rookie. And so I don't know what the obvious fix for that is, but it's not obvious. I mean, obviously you could be the Quayle exception and just not be able to get off the ground when you eventually run for president, but more likely. You would get the, you know, Nixon had less, in a sense, had less Washington experience than Eisenhower. Eisenhower being a general with war experience. I mean, Nixon, I think, was in Congress, but he was still pretty young when he was VP, and Eisenhower was outwardly dismissive of him in 1960, so he couldn't think of anything they did, you know, of substance. And he loses, he gets the nomination, in the pre-primary system, gets it pretty easily, loses the presidency by a hair. And doesn't get to the presidency until eight years later. And then, you know, after that, you don't really have a...
So let me just say this about, you know, so Biden's super old and not doing well. And there's nobody, it's not just Kamala. So Kamala reminds me of, like, if you watch football, every once in a while, you know, you'll see, like, you got to have a good quarterback nowadays, but you'll see, like, a quarterback and they might have a couple really good games, but they just don't have it. And, like, they're just, it's a matter of poise. You can just tell the body language sometimes, like, this quarterback is just not going to be, it's not going to be like an elite franchise quarterback. Maybe this could be a backup. Like, it's just, this QB doesn't have it. And like, it doesn't matter how many reps, it doesn't matter how hard they practice, like, they're just not gonna have it. And that's kind of Kamala. Like, she's had flashes of brilliance occasionally. But even in the Senate, remember that thing where I think it was the Brett, I forget what trial it was. She's had a couple of occasions where she like would go on these weird jags where she would like, it would almost appear that she had some devastating information she was going to drop and then nothing came of it. There's weird stuff like that. And it's just like, there's a demeanor, but put her aside. Like, what is it going to be? Pete Buttigieg, is he going to be the savior? Look, I don't think Pete Buttigieg is a guy. There's no bench, as far as I can tell.
Did George H.W. Bush have it? Was he this fantastic speaker that wowed the room? I mean, he was a guy, you know, I mean, George H.W. Bush is sort of analogous to Pence. Two guys with more Washington experience than their presidents.
Yeah.
But presidents with big personalities that overshadowed them. And you know, we'll see what happens with Pence going forward. That's an unknown whether he would get the nomination or what. But you know, H.W. Bush, you know, enters into the 88 primary, doesn't remotely clear the field. I mean, we this one person quoted in Politico saying there's no way Kamala clears the field. Well, what vice president did? You know, almost every VP that runs has opponents, and Bush had a ton of opponents. And Newsweek had the infamous wimp factor cover, fighting the wimp factor. I mean, he was treated like a runt, even though he had this massive, massive resume. But he had very little charisma. He spoke terribly. He made all sorts of gaffes.
Yeah.
But still was able to gut it out, because when you're VP, you do have that familiarity with at least with your party's base. And yeah. And let's face it. I mean, as much as race and gender is making people judge her more harshly now, maybe instead of being some unfair standards, within a Democratic primary, they could very well become assets again. I mean, even if Buttigieg has a good head of steam, you know,
but I mean,
that's going to cause a lot of strife. That why is someone with less experience, who wasn't in the vice presidential role, wasn't groomed for this, is now going to leapfrog over her? That battle would be very, and I don't know if Buttigieg wants to take that on, quite frankly. Why? Because he'll get scarred by that. I would, yeah. If I was him, like I'd take a pass on that and wait for Kamala to go up or down and then run afterwards.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like I said, it's not like he's this great, you know, great white hope or whatever. I mean, he's not that great. And he was like mayor of a small town, like, you know, anyway. But okay. So George H.W. Bush. Again, to the resume, right? So he was a congressman. He was a CIA director. I think he was the chairman of the RNC, maybe. Right. And then he was vice president Nixon, for 8 years. What's that?
Under Nixon. That was a rough RNC road for Bush.
I think he was an ambassador or something. I don't know. Yeah. But then he was like vice president for 8 years. And then, as you mentioned, doesn't clear the field in the primary. And then has to run a really negative campaign to get elected president. And then he's a one-term president. So if your goal is to compare Kamala to George H.W. Bush, A, he wasn't that awesome as a politician, as you noted. And then B, she's not as good as him. So, like, this is not a good...
I'm not even so sure about that. I mean, I think Bush was not a sure-footed politician. And you know, Kamala's has done some things of merit. I mean, she won some tough races in California.
She's a U.S. senator for 15 minutes, right? I mean, like, how long was she in the Senate even?
Well, it was less than a full term.
Okay.
And when she was nominated, she did provide a boost to Biden. They did bring in fundraising. It was a well-received pick. She didn't have any major problems in the presidential general election. So it's not
they
like...
They all did it from his basement. I mean, this election was the most, you know, choreographed, protected, safe campaign.
Hey, Biden made more gaffes in the general election than Kamala did. I mean, you can still gaffe on Zoom, and Biden did. So it's not like it was a risk-free environment. I'm not saying she is. I'm not saying she gets an A plus for her campaigning and her performance right now. But judge her on the same plane as other VPs. Almost all of them have had plenty of challenges. It's a tough position for anybody to perform well in, because you're given assignments with no power to execute those assignments.
I mean, I agree. Everything you say is true. But here's the problem, Bill. America's in trouble. Joe Biden's got like a 30% approval rating. He's a million years old. And the next guy in line is Donald Trump. Okay. And guess what? The Republicans don't have anybody good either. Like, we are in a country that desperately needs leadership, and there isn't anybody. Like, not only do we not have it in the White House now, I can't think of anybody. There was a time when I was very misguidedly of the opinion that, like, Marco Rubio, if we could just get Rubio in, I thought, like, everything would be great. And, like, but at least I had that guy, that person, you know, that possibility. Like, I don't think who out there could.
We have had lots of presidential elections where the two candidates are not great. it's not unusual.
But when America when our back's against the wall, we get a Reagan, an FDR, a Lincoln. Like, and now don't you feel like our back's against the wall now? Like, we can't settle for a Harding. You know what I mean? We need a Reagan or even a Bill Clinton in a different way, I think, would be a leader.
I mean, this is has been a tense time in the past years because of the pandemic. But as far as I'm concerned, like, I do see a lot of light into the tunnel here. Like, we are getting out of this pandemic. We are getting our vaccines. The political system, even under Trump, for Pete's sake, managed to infuse the economy with enough cash so we didn't all become destitute. You know, we solved some big problems here. And look, Biden's legislative agenda is in pretty good shape. Assuming Build Back Better gets passed, which I think it will, like, whatever happens with Biden, bad midterm, one-term president, you look back and say, you know what? Got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah.
Looked ahead, looked forward thinking, passed a lot of stuff, invested in the future. So, like, we have been much, much worse off as a country than where we are right now.
No, I've made that argument too, but I think that the problem America faces now, I mean, I realize we just spent an hour talking about inflation, you know, but the big problem America faces now is more of a, like, spiritual problem in a sense. It has to do with, like, leadership and unity and coming together. Those times demand a strong, charismatic, and principled, I think, leader. And I don't know who that person is.
So, you know, I was dipping in. There's a whole bunch. I got three Carter books on my shelf. And there's two new ones that came out in the past year. It's Kai Bird's The Outlier, and there's Jonathan Alter's His Very Best. But before then, that's why there was this book called President Carter, The White House Years by Stuart Eisenstadt, who was in the Carter White House. And I find, I've not read it cover to cover, but this is such a well-written and detailed book. Every time I'm like, you know, what did Carter do in that period? And I go to that section and I'm like, I get it. Like, it's like always there, like the details that I need. So what's really, like, what you just said, you know, is very much what was on Carter's mind during the whole malaise speech period. And, you know, Pat Caddell, who was, you know, only 29 and was considered this wunderkind, was telling Carter all what you just said, you know, that this sort of psychological depression in the country, this crisis of confidence. Yeah. And Mondale was just beside himself that Carter was listening to this idiot and this psychobabble nonsense. And I'm just trying to find the And they actually had a meeting where
Mondale, and by the way, John Ward, I don't know if you read John Ward's book, but John Ward, who is at Yahoo, former colleague of mine at the Daily Caller, wrote a good book about this as well. And you're right. I mean, Carter did talk about, and I think it was probably a mistake for Carter, even though Carter was right on the merits. I believe that America at that time faced this malaise, this lack of belief and optimism. And, you know, I think his diagnosis was absolutely correct, but I don't know that talking about it openly to the American public was a good idea. In fact, I think it was probably a bad idea, but that was the problem. And I think Reagan actually, without actually talking about it, helped solve the problem.
So this is Eisenstadt talking. This is a meeting that Cadell and Carter and Mondale had. My brother's in the room, too. It says, Cadell then piled on, and turning with a fiery gaze that I could imagine on the face of the prophet Jeremiah decrying the misdeeds of its people. This gave Cadell the visage of someone more than twice his young years. As far back as December 1978, even before the gas lines, his polls had picked up massive pessimism among the American people. To him, the fact that there was no positive movement after Carter's Middle East successes meant that, quote, something else was out there, unquote. Or the Camp David Accords had happened right before soon before the midterms, and there wasn't all that much of a bump, if my chronology correctly. Cadell then waxed eloquent about the broader afflictions of the American body politic. This is Eisenstadt talking. I almost felt I was at a seance, not a serious meeting with the leader of the free world. Cadell divined that, quote, when the country had gotten rich, it turned away from its core values, unquote, of thrift, hard work, family, and a belief in the common good. Citing Alex de Tocqueville, the French observer of democracy, they turned to the president and first lady and told them that until 6 weeks before, he believed Carter would be reelected because he would stand above the other candidates, quote, but this has changed, unquote. It says Eisenhower gave a counter, and then he writes, if I thought I had been blunt, the vice president, unreconciled and angry, turn not only on Cadell, but on Carter himself. Quote, Mr. President, we got elected on the ground that we want a government as good as the people. Now, as I hear it, we want to tell them that we need a people as good as the government. I don't think that's going to sell. We're blaming the public, and there are plenty of reasons the public is upset, unquote. Mondale brushed aside Cadell's apocalyptic explanation of assassinations, Vietnam, and Watergate, and said plainly that people, quote, can't get gas, interest rates are soaring, basic industry is disappearing, people can't follow what's going on anymore. There's plenty of reasons for the American people to want answers without having their mental stability questioned. If we do that, I think we're goners, unquote.
Yeah. And I think Mondale had the right political instincts on that one.
And then soon after, he privately talked about quitting Mondale.
Yeah.
And although he then said afterwards they were just, you know, blowing off steam. But that's how angry he was. And so what was interesting is that Carter takes Cadell's advice, gives that speech. It's a well-received speech.
Yeah.
And then he screws it up by asking his cadre for mass resignations, and it looks like they're rudderless all over again.
Now, you know what's interesting too is I just wrote about, my last column was about Richard Ben Kramer's book What It Takes from 1988. And Pat Cadell was an advisor to Joe Biden back then.
Right.
And everybody who read the book 25 years ago, they remember, you know, Bob Dole with the arm, and they remember Joe Biden losing, you know, his wife. But what most people don't remember is other parts about Biden. So like Joe Biden wanted to run for president, but he had no reason to run for president. It was almost like a Ted Kennedy type situation. Mm-hmm. So he assembled this huge team of advisors to try to help him come up with a reason. Like before he had a reason, he had the advisors. This is a point. And Pat Cadell heard this Genesis. By the way, Genesis was in Washington, D.C. like this week, I believe, performing. He heard this song from the band, I guess the progressive band Genesis or whatever, called Land of Confusion. I don't know if you know that song. You probably know that song, Bill. It was like very anti-Reagan, but it was, but there was a line in there like about generational change and generational, you know, transformation. And so Pat Caddell kind of alighted on that as the theme. And then, but the funny part is that like Biden had to like admit to him, like, you know, I miss the 60s. Like I was wearing sports jackets in the 60s. And like, I was, you know, I have no, like, I have no connection to this at all.
Right.
That's kind of the funny part. You have to read my column to, you know, Richard Ben Kramer wrote it better than I could tell it. But the larger point is that like, you know, Biden had this ambition, but didn't have a rationale for running. And you had Pat Caddell, and this very kind of hippie, like, you know, listening to Genesis to come up, like, you know, and like watching movies like The Big Chill and listening to like rock music to come up with like a theme for a presidential campaign. He was an interest. He still is alive, right? He's an interesting cat, no doubt.
Well, Matt, we've talked for a solid hour. Good show as always.
Something.
Anything to plug?
No, just keep reading me at the Beast and check out my podcast. You can watch a lot of them at youtube.com/Matt Lewis. That's it for me. How about you, Bill?
Well, I got my Ken Biden Whip Inflation Now piece up at the Monthly. I guess that's it for things to plug.
Yeah.
I got some things though coming up, but you'll see them soon enough. And you can't Zoom tomorrow, is that right?
Can't. No. My wife and I are heading out to celebrate, kind of early celebration for our anniversary. So I'm out of pocket. We got to do a DM. Maybe we do a pre-Thanksgiving one. I'm not sure.
No, I'm down for that. But I'll probably do a solo Zoom tomorrow for my Patreon supporters. Since you're out, and last week I was out of town with my wife for a little mini getaway.
I'm okay with not doing them every week, but I feel bad now because it's been a few weeks and but you know, it'll make people love us more, and maybe we could do. You know, we'll see what the future holds, but we will be back.
The boys I guess we need to figure out what our Thanksgiving week plan is, if we're going to do DMZ, DM Zoom. But
that's a good point. If we do, that's really kind of the problem, is that like we're already doing this, so it's, you know, so. Maybe we should find a way to do these live with quit doing the DMZ and just make the DM Zoom our whole thing.
All right, we'll work on a holiday schedule soon. And so I'll see you one way or another soon enough back here in the DMZ.
All right. See ya.